There was, of course, more to this story, and Dennis Neal is quick to point out that he was merely piggybacking on the pre-existing lobbying efforts of General Dynamics. They're the ones who introduced Charlie to Egypt, because F-16s are the mainstay of Egyptian foreign aid, and F-16s are made in Texas. But the essential ingredient that Neal added to the mix was the smiling face of Abu Razala. Once the issue of Egyptian aid became personalized in Wilson's mind, there was almost nothing he wouldn't do to get his friend Mohammed his fair share of the U.S. taxpayers' money. Now, whenever Abu Razala came to the congressman's office, he was treated as Tzvi Rafia's equal, and that was saying a lot. Rafia had always acted as if he owned Wilson's office. One of the staffers kept a list of people he needed to lobby. He would use the phones, give projects to the staff, and call on Charlie to intervene whenever he needed him. Abu Razala's lobbying style was as industrious as Tzvi's, and the office quickly learned to treat his causes as every bit as important. Wilson always delivered for his friend Mohammed. When the congressman's plane approached the Cairo runway in March 1983, he had just shepherded through a foreign assistance package for Egypt worth $1 billion. Mohammed knew the importance of acknowledging such a gesture, and if it meant rolling out a red carpet for a collection of Israelis whom the congressman had brought along for the ride, so be it. When the door to the unmarked plane opened, a military band struck up the Yellow Rose of Texas. Top brass were everywhere on the runway, cutting salutes to Wilson as if he too were a field marshal. For Carol, her fantasy about Nefertiti was being fulfilled on the spot. "I was received like a queen," she says. "A convoy swept us away." At the hotel, the congressman signed Carol in as Mrs. Wilson, whispering that it was against the law to sleep in the same room if you weren't married. Carol had a moment of fright in the lobby when she overheard two Arabs from Saudi Arabia talking about a princess who had just been beheaded for sleeping with a man she wasn't married to. As a gesture to calm the worries of his Israeli guests, Mohammed placed armed guards outside the bedrooms of each of the congressman's friends. This only caused Gila to become convinced she had been taken prisoner. But nothing could diminish Carol's thrill when Abu Razala told her he was looking forward to her performance that evening. One might think it would be like carrying coals to Newcastle for a U.S. congressman to bring his own belly dancer to entertain the second most powerful man in Egypt. But Carol Shannon had a surprise in store for him. In Egypt, in those years of renewed fundamentalism, it was dangerous for a belly dancer to perform moves deemed too suggestive by the Muslim hierarchy. To Carol's surprise, belly dancers were not permitted to show their bare arms or their bellies, which had to be covered with fishnet. No pelvic grinds were allowed, not even the floor routine that was the staple of her performance. That night in Cairo, with the nervous Israelis seated at the table and a beaming Charlie Wilson offering encouragement, Carol Shannon decided not to give in to the Muslim fundamentalists any more than she had to her own Christian extremists back home. "I figured, just arrest me, I'm going to do it my way." It's not possible to fully appreciate the impact of a belly dancer without being the person for whom the performance is given. In Carol Shannon's routine, the Pasha, the great man for whom she performs, sits on a chair in the middle of the floor as the dancer, often with two or three other women writhing next to her, begins to circle. "Don't breathe," she commanded as she pulled a sword out of a sheath and shimmied up to within inches of the defense minister's face. It was less than 2 years since the assassination of Egypt's President Sadat, and the minister's bodyguards lurched out of their seats. Wilson snapped at them to back off. Shannon, with her bare arms and undulating naked belly, was now violating all of the taboos, surrounding the field marshal with her veils and exposing, for his eyes only, her heaving breasts and pelvic grinds. Abu Razala had never before experienced this variation on his country's dance, and he was far too entranced to worry when she moved the sword from near his head and aimed it at his groin. This was the signature moment that this Dallas belly dancer had built into all of her performances. For her, it had a special meaning. "It's the only time I have real power over a man," she explains. But in Cairo that night, it was all too much for the bodyguards when she pulled back her sword as if she were about to plunge it straight into the field marshal. They sprang to their feet, which only heightened the impact of her dance, as she laughed boldly and knowingly at the great and powerful man before her. For a fleeting moment she had threatened the field marshal's manhood, and now she was returning it with a laugh and a look that seemed to be an invitation. "He was foaming through his eyes," remembers Carol. "Charlie had to tell him, 'You can't touch her,' and he respected that, but he told me he wanted me to return to Egypt as his guest." That night, Carol Shannon went to bed convinced that she was in the country of her ancestors. There was also business to be transacted on this trip, so Charlie arranged for Carol, now accompanied by the Rafias, to ride camels into the desert and to visit the pyramids. Meanwhile, at the Defense Ministry, he told Abu Razala that he needed to be able to do an end run around the timid CIA. Specifically, he wanted to know if Mohammed had any weapons in his arsenal that could make a difference for the Afghans. Abu Razala smiled and declared that Charlie need look no further. Until Sadat changed sides in the late 1970s, Egypt had been a Soviet client state. Its warehouses were filled with Soviet weapons, and its factories were still tooled to manufacture Soviet-licensed material. Egypt was already providing some of the weapons in the CIA's Afghan pipeline, but Abu Razala explained that there was no end to the quantity and sophistication of what he could provide, and because of their friendship, he assured Wilson, there would be no problems whatsoever in getting Egypt to go along. No one else need be involved. No Foreign Office discussions would be necessary. If Charlie could get the money, Abu Razala would supply everything else to bring down the gunships. The Texan was now in full throttle, violating diplomatic taboos at every stop, bringing Israeli spies and movie stars to Cairo, commissioning the Israelis to design an anti-aircraft gun for the CIA, and negotiating secret weapons deals with the Egyptian defense minister. He had also made Carol Shannon's life complete. She could go home now knowing that she had danced in Cairo and won the heart of a modern pharaoh. "Ladies and gentlemen, we will be arriving in Karachi, inshallah, God willing, in 4 hours. This is the prayer that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, always recited at the start of any travel." When Wilson's Pakistan International Airways jet glided to a halt in Karachi, the U.S. Embassy's control officer was waiting on the runway. The ambassador had been cabling frenetically, "Please advise R.E. identity of Congressman Wilson's traveling companion." Wilson had been careful not to reveal Carol's identity to the American press corps, which had hounded him in both Texas and Washington. They would have had a field day if they had discovered that the scandal-ridden congressman was headed off on a junket with a belly dancer. In fact, Carol was so sensitive to Wilson's precarious political position that she never even developed her photographs from the trip. In Jerusalem, the congressman had felt so safe in the hands of old friends that he told them everything about Carol. In Cairo, he had artfully dealt with the prohibitions against cohabitation by saying Shannon was his wife. But by the time he reached Zia's rigorously Islamic nation, Wilson realized it was not safe to flout local custom. Here it wasn't uncommon to see women dressed in burqas, and Wilson decided not to take any risks. He sternly told Carol to wear lots of clothes, show no skin, and avoid seeming too friendly. The congressman had come to Pakistan on a mission that not even his own government knew about, and he was doing his best to be discreet. He now introduced his belly dancer to everyone as a member of his staff. It was his one gesture to propriety, and amazingly, he thought people would believe him, even though Carol insisted on wearing the skin-tight jumpsuits she had bought specially for the trip. Wilson's first objective was to visit the victims of the so-called toy bombs, tiny anti-personnel mines that the Soviets were reported to be spreading all over the Afghan countryside, maiming children who unsuspectingly picked them up. And so, for the second time, he flew to Peshawar and visited the International Rescue Committee Hospital, where he once again gave blood for the jihad. He wouldn't allow Carol to come along. He said it was too sad. For Charlie Wilson, however, it was always strangely energizing to visit these warriors whose conviction was so great that they never complained. Going to the front did not seem all that dangerous to this self-destructive congressman. On the contrary, losing himself in the presence of these fearless victims, knowing that the Red Army was just over the border, always liberated him from the terrors of his personal life. He was engaging in what psychiatrists call counterphobic behavior, finding one horror to force out the memory of another. At home, he was his own worst enemy. In Pakistan, there was a real enemy just across the mountain range. Throughout the entire Afghan campaign, twice a year or more, Wilson would always visit this hospital. He would do it to renew his fury at the Soviets, almost like Zia's repeated visits to Mecca for inspiration. Wilson's entire imagination and value system as a boy had been shaped by the wonder of the outgunned British fighting on against the Nazis to defend everyone's freedom when there seemed to be no hope. Here in the hospital, the words of his boyhood inspiration Winston Churchill would swirl in his consciousness as he moved about the wounded Afghans. "We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender."